KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Sunnyvale, down by Great America.
Sunset District.
In between Cupertino and Saratoga.
San Jose.
Oakland.
Antioch.
Half Moon Bay.
Coming up, there's a big proposed development in Alameda. We'll hear how residents feel about it.
We need the homes, but we need to deal with the problems it will cause.
Then San Francisco is designating a parking lot where people living without homes can sleep.
They're also proposing shower facilities and places where people can rest and connect to services.
A new solution for the housing crunch in San Francisco. And how Muni's oldest streetcar survived the chopping block.
He hid them in the back of the car house. So he would stash them there, and they were out of sight, out of mind.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Usually the conversation about Bay Area development centers around San Francisco and Oakland, the big cities. But there's lots of construction happening in smaller areas too, like Alameda. A real estate company recently proposed a big development plan for the island. Here with more is KALW's East Oakland reporter, Janae Darden. Hi, Janae.
Hey, Ben.
So what is this big plan people are buzzing about in Alameda?
All right. So right along Shoreline Drive, right across from Alameda's beach, is the South Shore Shopping Center.
All right.
It's about 46 acres. Jamestown, the real estate company that owns the land, wants to change it to a mixed-use property by adding over 1,200 multifamily residential units. And there'll be some retail spaces, restaurants, and park area, too.
Well, that sounds pretty good in a vacuum, but what's got to go in order to make that happen?
Well, Ben, you know, so many of the stores are already gone at the South Shore Shopping Center. And as we know, a lot of malls, they're on life support.
That's true.
And South Shore lost Radio Shack, Payless, Charmy Charlie, and other retail businesses. Jamestown says they're working with some of the existing stores and restaurants on the future and on relocation. Safeway and Trader Joe's are doing well because, you know, people have to eat.
Sure.
But some of the other stores that are left are struggling to stay open. And one store that just announced they're going out of business is the Alameda Beauty Center. And this is a family-run business that's been at the mall since 1985.
Oh.
I actually go there to get my nail polish.
Okay.
But I spoke with the owner. His name is Peter Shimoni, and he's 60 years old.
Yeah, it's just stuff. And it's like forced retirement, I feel like. I didn't think I was going to be at this stage in my life and have to, do this and not know about the future for myself. It, it's very challenging. You know, with big box stores, the internet, and then Ulta opened up 2013, and that was really difficult.
So Ulta is a major beauty store. It's like Sephora.
Yep, I got a daughter.
Yeah, okay. Well, for those who don't know. But Peter will still run a smaller beauty store in Sonoma.
What kind of timeline are we looking at here for this project?
Yes, this will not be overnight. It's going to take years. And the project is supposed to be completed in phases. So the first two phases, it should be done by like 2027. And the other phases are dependent on if like big stores such as Ross or Office Depot, Kohl's, if they're still open after the first phases.
Oh, uh-huh.
Plus, it's going to take a few years for their proposed plan to go through an environmental review by the city.
That's interesting that they're wondering if these large stores are still going to be there because they're kind of projecting the future of retail here as well.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So this is on Alameda, and this is the island that's just off of Oakland. Now, you live there, Janae. Tell us a little bit more of the insider perspective you got on it.
Okay, so it's small, right? It's about 6 miles long, 1 mile wide, 78,000 people, which is one-fifth of Oakland's population.
Mm.
Very charming, good school system. Many of the residents there are middle, upper class, low crime. Everything you need is there. You don't have to leave the island. And there's a lot of community pride. And one thing, the island is 25 miles per hour speed limit. And so people in Alameda are very serious, but do not go over 25 miles an hour. They're very serious about it.
Well, so I know that in small towns, there's always a lot of talk, a lot of gossip, a lot of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So what are residents saying about this new project idea?
Yeah, I was even just walking around in the last few weeks just hearing people talking about it. But I went to an event that Jamestown hosted for people from the community to ask questions and learn more about the proposal. Residents asked about affordable housing, of course. Jamestown says about 15% of the units will be designated affordable for people with low to moderate income. Many asked about building housing so close close to the ocean because of the rising sea levels.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and it's right along the beach. Plus, the mall was built on landfill. But Jamestown says they're going to research to make sure it'll be safe for earthquakes and higher sea levels.
Yeah, well, they should.
Yeah, and people are saying, you know, the solution to housing shortages is to build more housing. And some people feel like the developers are just going to come, change everything, leave, make a mess while residents try to figure out what to do.
Make some money.
Yeah, make some money, definitely. Longtime residents are concerned Alameda is going to lose its small town feel, you know, with this project and other projects. But it seems no matter people's opinion, there's one big question on everyone's mind, Ben.
Is that right? What?
Traffic.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, more people, more cars.
That's right. And so I've noticed, even living there the last several years, an increase in traffic. And so you have to drive through Alameda to get to South Shore Shopping Center. It's not like it's right off the freeway. But Jamestown claims traffic may be reduced in that area because less people will be there to shop. But we're still talking about over 1,000 units, which means more people living there. Alan Saxton is a man I talked to. He's lived in Alameda for 56 years, and he has mixed feelings. He's concerned about traffic during the years of construction.
We need the homes, but we need to deal with the problems that will cause at the same time, rather than dealing with the problems later after people's lives are miserable.
You say you feel like people will be miserable. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Just the traffic, parking. A lot of it does revolve around our beloved cars.
You've lived here much of your life, and so it'll look like a different place.
That's okay. Things change. When today's kids are my age, it'll be different still. It's just the way things are.
Do you think this project, Janae, points to other changes that are happening in Alameda as well?
Absolutely. You know, development is not just happening at South Shore Shopping Center. There's been talks about building a BART station on the west end of Alameda, which is near the tube that leads into downtown Oakland. Last year, developers started on a $1 billion project to build 800 housing units and some commercial buildings on the Old Navy base. A few hotels are being built in the city, too. So there's a lot going on, a lot of building.
This is a changing place, just like the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So speaking of that, you are the East Oakland reporter for KALW. How would the proposed South Shore development affect East Oakland, which is right across the water?
Well, it could possibly add to traffic congestion because drivers have to drive off the island into Oakland to get to the freeway or to get to BART, which is how I get to work, especially during commute time, and it can be congested. I met a lot of people from Oakland there when I was just, you know, working on this piece. And I met a number of Alameda residents who had no clue about this proposed development.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It's going to be so impactful in their lives.
Right.
They don't even know.
Right. So if people want to learn more, they have questions. Jamestown is having office hours on Thursday, September 5th.
That's this Thursday.
Yeah, this Thursday from 4 to 8 p.m. in Suite 280 at South Shore Center, right across from one of my favorite places, See's Candy.
Okay, mine too. All right, well, if you want to see that information in print, you could go to KALW.org for more information. Thank you, Janae.
Thank you.
Janae Darden is KALW's East Oakland reporter. You can reach her at janae@kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. We'll cross over to San Francisco for our next story, which is about a different kind of new development. On Thursday, the City and County's Planning Commission unanimously approved a proposal to designate a parking lot near Balboa Park BART station for long-term parking and overnight camping in vehicles. This approach has already been tried in Oakland, Palo Alto, and San Jose, but it's a novel move for San Francisco. KALW's Taylor Caldwell dropped by the location to see what it looks and feels like.
I am standing at the corner of Geneva Avenue and San Jose Avenue in the parking lot that is going to be used for overnight camping and parking. Across the street from me is the Balboa Park BART station. To the right is a Muni stop and a bus stop. Across the street is a cafe and grill. And then behind me are lots of homes and the freeway. So it is a fairly busy intersection. It's very loud. The parking lot itself is a narrow lot that opens up at Niagara and Geneva. It's surrounded by 12-foot fencing, and it has about 33 spaces in it.
The proposal to allow people to stay for up to 90 days still needs to be heard by the full Board of Supervisors, and they'll have to consider the details. Laura Waxman has been covering this issue for the San Francisco Examiner. I spoke with her earlier today. Laura, we just heard what the site looks like. What exactly is proposed for this location?
Hi. Yes. So this is a novel proposal for the city, and it is currently, the site that we're talking about is along San Jose and Geneva, and it's currently a parking lot for used by muni operators. What the city is proposing there are 33 parking spots. About 30 of those would be for people who are considered homeless, who are currently living in large vehicles, RVs, and passenger cars. And 3 of those spots would be for, you know, the staff that kind of mans the site and makes sure that everything's okay and does security there. They're also proposing shower facilities and places where people can rest and connect to services. It's case management on site.
So with that much limited space, it seems like they couldn't do that many services. It's not like a navigation center quite.
It's not like a navigation center, no. I think the point of this is to get people into navigation centers. You know, that's Jeff Kozitsky, who's the director of the Department of Homelessness, was saying that his vision for this lot would be people come in, they get their cars checked out, they get some of the services that they need, they have a place to rest that's safe, but the bigger picture is to connect people to services and have them eventually possibly even give up their RVs.
So in this RV lot, would there be hookups for power and water the way that other RV spaces do?
Yeah, so there's Wi-Fi access. There are showers that they will be bringing there on site, restrooms, exactly. They were talking about having food there as well in kitchens, but that seems no longer part of the proposal.
Would they have sewage pumping systems for the RVs?
Yes, exactly. And also, you know, I think as far as I understood, they're also having people can get their RVs maintained, maintenance services on site. Because a lot of people, you know, sometimes they get stuck because their cars break down and they don't have the money to fix them.
Would people have to pay to park in this lot?
No, it's referral-based. So there's no payments. You know, if you're eligible for it, then you have a 90-day spot, and I believe there's also an option to renew that time frame so you can stay there longer.
And who would be eligible for it?
So what I understand is that these are people who are currently living in RVs. Priority is being given to families. That seems to have been kind of a big push from the department, that they want to get people who have children out of RVs and into shelters. And there's a lot of space. This is what I heard from Jeff Kozitsky. There's a lot of space right now in the family shelter system, so that's really a focus. Also people who are disabled, who have been chronically homeless on the street for long periods of time and living in RVs. Those are the people that they're giving priority to.
How do people prove that?
That's a good question. I'm assuming that, you know, there has been an RV resolution team that's been working for, I think, a year now or a little bit less. I'm sure that some of these people are already connected to services. There are hot teams that go out and actually visit RVs and check on people. So I'm sure they have their methods. I'm not quite sure how they are vetting people.
Mm-hmm. The hot teams, those homeless outreach teams.
Exactly.
So the full Board of Supervisors approved this conceptually back in April. What kind of discussions and debate have you heard about the idea now that it's approaching reality?
There seems to be a lot of buy-in from the city. It seems like almost everyone's on board from what I've heard. The Planning Commission approved it unanimously on Thursday, as you know. Asha Safai, District 11 Supervisor, and Valley Brown are behind this. Supervisor Ronan from the Mission District had already proposed a navigation center for RV dwellers a while back, and she kind of suspended that proposal to make way for this. For this initiative, which has a mayor's backing. So there seems to be a lot of buy-in from City Hall. As far as the neighbors go, there were some concerns. There have been several community meetings leading up to Thursday's Planning Commission hearing. And I went to a few of those, and some of the neighbors still had concerns about safety, which is pretty typical, I would say, for most shelters or services opening up in a neighborhood. But the department is guaranteeing that there will be security on site 24/7 and that this would actually enliven this parking lot that is now empty at night.
Have you seen those concerns borne out by an increased volume of people who don't have homes in different neighborhoods, whether it's the Mission or elsewhere?
Well, that's interesting because I lived in the Mission District for a long time. I'm in Potrero now, but I have covered when Supervisor Hillary Ronan was really behind the effort to open navigation centers in her district. And I covered the opening of several of those. And even now, when I walk by and they're still operating, I think that the areas around them are a lot cleaner and safer, just from my perspective as somebody who walks by, because, you know, there's effort there and there's people who are looking out and who are making sure that, you know, there's no loitering in front of these centers because there's so much political pressure and pressure from neighbors. Mm-hmm. So I do think that these actually, in some sense, at least address some of the quality of life issues that residents are worried about as far as crime. Statistically speaking, from the department and from the police department, we've heard that crime actually stays the same or drops a little bit around navigation centers. You know, personally, I can't speak to that, but that's what we're being told.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that this neighborhood has one of the lower homelessness rates in the city. Why'd they choose this parking lot?
Well, first of all, this is an interim use of the site. So this parking lot is slated for housing. It's going to be 100% affordable housing. They're breaking ground within 2 years. So this is a good, seems to be a good interim use of this site specifically. Also, you know, there was some talk about it being close to public transportation and just kind of away from a lot of the residential pockets in that district. But for me, I think that the biggest thing is that they want this to be an interim use. It's temporary. It's not going up forever. It's an experiment, in a sense.
And do you know if there are plans to create more overnight parking areas in San Francisco?
Yeah, definitely. So I know that the Planning Commission, even, I was covering that hearing, and one of the commissioners was saying, we need more of this. I know that Valley Brown has said that she would like to have at least a second site somewhere. I don't know if that's in her district or in D11. But yeah, there's definitely talk of opening more of these if this is successful.
Mm-hmm. So what's next immediately?
So the next thing is this would move to the Board of Supervisors. I think it goes to land use first and then to the full board. If it's approved, which, you know, it looks like there's a lot of buy-in, if it's approved, then this could open up in November.
That's Laura Waxman. She writes for the San Francisco Examiner. Find links to her work and more on this story at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. That corner of San Francisco's Balboa Park we were just talking about has been a transit hub for a long time. In fact, the city's historic streetcars are still housed just a block away at the Cameron Beach Yard. Those streetcars run on the F line along the Embarcadero and up Market Street, providing an old-timey and practical ride to commuters and tourists alike. The city's celebrating them with Muni Heritage Weekend this Saturday and Sunday. We're going to get a jump start today with a story from our archives by Magnolia McKay. It's about a humble little streetcar that was once the laughing stock of the city, but ended up transforming the face of transit in San Francisco.
I'm on the yard where San Francisco's oldest working streetcar lives. When I get there, it's surrounded by Muni workers in blue shirts. They're excited because this antique streetcar doesn't get out much. They call it the Dinky.
This car, it's got an ancient controller, so you have to be very careful with it.
Robert Parks works for Muni. He shows me how he drives the Dinky. You apply power, release the brake, ring the gong, and get going. Dinky is adorable. It's short and boxy, painted a cheerful yellow color, and it still has its 19th century woodwork. To be honest, the ride is rather bumpy, but there was a time when this was the smoothest, quickest way around the city. Let's go back to the 1890s when streetcars first hit the scene in San Francisco. If you want to talk streetcars, transit historian Emiliano Echeverria is your man. He's a lifelong rail fan and even did track maintenance in the cable car system.
The electric trolley car was high tech. In its day, it was the thing going on.
In that time, the transit companies were all privately owned. Emiliano tells me that Dinky was built for one of these private companies in 1896. It was given the number 578 and painted yellow. The color indicated its route.
Which was very important because there were many, many people at that time who were either immigrants who were not familiar with English or people who were actually illiterate who couldn't read or write at all.
Back then, car number 578 was actually one of many dinkies. All short, small streetcars were called dinkies because of their size. But by the early 1900s, the dinkies were already going out of style, getting replaced by bigger streetcars. Our dinky could have easily gone to the scrapyard. But then came the great earthquake of 1906. The earthquake and fire leveled most of the city. And remember, this is before automobiles. So to rebuild, the rail companies turned their dinkies into construction vehicles.
There were streetcars for carrying tools. There were streetcars for towing a wrecked car, streetcars for carrying sand, even cars for lifting track out of the street, everything.
Our dinky became a sand car. San Francisco's famous hills and fog make rail transit a bit too slippery at times. So dinky's new job was to drop sand on the rails to give passenger streetcars more traction. And actually, streetcars still do that today, only now they carry their own sand on board. But back to dinky. When it went to work, it was boarded up, stripped of its seats, and painted a dull green. The life of a sand car was far less glamorous than that of a passenger streetcar. But getting this assignment was Dinky's first lucky break, because old cars that didn't get a job, they were scrapped. Not our Dinky. Dinky worked as a sand car for decades.
World War I happens.
Dinky is delivering sand.
World War II happens. The Depression happens.
Dinky is still delivering sand. But its life was about to be threatened again. In the 1940s, Muni was expanding and took over the last of the private rail companies. But after two wars and a depression, those tracks and streetcars were in terrible shape. So in 1947, Muni put a bunch of bond measures on the ballot.
Let's raise money to rebuild the railway. Let's buy buses, let's buy trolley coaches, get those darn streetcars and those darn tracks off the streets.
Muni had a parade to raise support for the propositions.
And let's get the most decrepit, most ancient-looking thing we've got.
And they found our dinky. They painted a slogan on it. My wheels are flat, my body sags, my upholstery is in rags.
Please vote for 1-7 and send me to streetcar heaven.
Dinky was the poster child for Muni's crumbling infrastructure, paraded around the streets of San Francisco like the bad kid in a dunce cap. It worked. The props to modernize Muni passed. That meant more buses and fewer rail cars. There wasn't much use for a sand car anymore, so it looked like Dinky's fate was sealed. The writing was literally written on its wall. One by one, the sand cars went to the wrecker.
Whoop, that went the sand car to the wrecker.
But then, Dinky got its second lucky break. It caught the eye of a Muni shop foreman named Charles Smallwood. He happened to be a rail fanatic, and he saw the beauty underneath the years of wear and tear. He got the idea to restore Dinky and some other old work cars.
He hid them in the back of the car house. So he would stash them there, and they were out of sight, out of mind.
So this guy had the gall to hide something bigger than an elephant until he raised the funds to have it restored.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long.
In 1956, Smallwood raised enough funds to restore Dinky to its former beauty. And the car that was once the dingiest in Muni's fleet became a show car. Dinky was sent to museums, and it starred in parades. Even a campaign parade for Richard Nixon.
Nixon now. Nixon now.
But Dinky's most crucial role came in 1983. At that time, San Francisco's iconic cable car system was being overhauled. That meant that all of the cable cars would be out of service for almost 2 years. City officials were worried that that would be bad for tourism, so they had an idea.
Let's run historic streetcars up and down Market from the Castro to the Bay Bridge Terminal, and that will satisfy people's, you know, desire to ride historic rail equipment.
Dinky was one of the stars of the show. It started as a one-time festival and...
Well, the darn thing was a blasting success.
San Francisco decided to make it a regular thing. Muni ran the restored cars they had and then started importing more historic cars from all over the world.
That's the F line.
F, as in festival. Emiliano says that when the historic streetcars started running back in the 80s, downtown had a depressed look about it.
Nobody likes to get on a dreary, depressing bus or streetcar. You want to get on something that's nice, pretty. And the F-Line shows the transit can be fun. It can be pretty. It can be enjoyable.
I think it's really charming.
This is Norris Hung. I find him on the platform in front of the ferry building. One might think of the historic fleet as something for tourists, but Norris is a local, and he takes the F from time to time.
It's a really cool mix of something that seems both like a relic of San Francisco, but also practical.
In a rapidly growing city that's covered in construction cranes, the F-Line connects us to our past. Dinky only comes out for special occasions now. It's over 120 years old. But its legacy lives on. If Dinky hadn't been rescued and restored, we might not have an F-Line now. Who would have imagined that a dusty old sand car from the 1890s would inspire a whole fleet of vintage streetcars? Our Dinky came from humble beginnings, but it's now the crown jewel of Muni's fleet. In San Francisco, I'm Magnolia McKay for Cross Currents.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell.
Sing, Dinky sing, will be out for its annual ride for Muni Heritage Weekend. That's this weekend. Find more info at kalw.org. And while you're there, go on and subscribe to our podcast. You'll see all the stories we air to keep you informed about the Bay Area. And you can pick and choose what you want to hear.
When he smiled, I could feel the car shake.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Sophie Codner, Lisa Morehouse, Troop Wynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adel. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Treffney.
As he started to go, then I started to know how it feels.